Well, obviously, we're entering a new unit since you just done taking the test for Unit 1. The second unit will be a collection of chapters that really make up a survey of major groups of organisms. And the one we'll start with for tonight is one that's called called Early Life and the Diversification of Prokaryotes. Speaking of early life, the opening slide here is an artist's rendition of what the Earth might have looked like early on in the history of biology. Remember that there is almost a billion years of Earth history before there's any organisms, right? In that Hadean eon, where life hadn't evolved yet and really conditions were not yet amenable to life. Not only did the molecules not exist yet that were proper, but also it was just hellishly hot, which is why it was named the Hadean. But once you have the first cells, then you have the formation of, the only reason that there's any indication of life here is that you have these things that look like rocks. And these are the oldest fossils that we have. They date back almost as far as we're putting the beginning of life. Anyone remember what these are called? I mentioned them earlier. Our oldest fossils. Stromatolites, you remember me saying this? They when you see it as a fossil, it looks like a rock because that's just the fossilized remains of what was many, many prokaryotic cells, early prokaryotic cells that lived a colonial lifestyle together, and because of secretions that they made, it would fossilize. Anyway, that's what these yellowish things are. But now, of course, there's a lot more variety of life. But all living organisms are organisms for what reason? For what is the bare minimum requirement for being an organism? What do you have to be an organism? No? Someone over here say something? Technically not. Well, I mean, just bluntly, no, because a virus has DNA, and a virus is not an organism. Why is a virus not an organism? Because it doesn't have at least one cell. The cell is the functional unit of life. And so cell theory, what we call cell theory in biology, says that all cells come from pre-existing cells. In other words, cells don't just pop into existence. A cell is created when a cell that was already there splits into two new cells. This is the way it's been throughout the history of life. But obviously this can't always have been true, right? If all cells come from pre-existing cells, that then leads to the question, well, what was the original cell? Well, the reason I'm bringing this up, pertinent to this chapter, is that the original cells, that original successful lineage of cells that is the ancestor to everything alive now, the base of that tree of life that I keep mentioning, was a prokaryotic cell. There's the dichotomy of cell types, right? Prokaryotes, eukaryotes. Prokaryotic cells, eukaryotic cells. Well, eukaryotic cells were not on the scene at all for a long time after there were already cells. the original cells to come into existence were prokaryotic cells, and that's what we're focusing on in this chapter. And so that's at least 3.5 billion years ago that happened. There are still prokaryotic cells, right? And in fact, in terms of individuals, because prokaryotic organisms are unicellular organisms, and therefore one cell is an individual. In terms of individuals, almost all organisms that have ever existed have been prokaryotes. That's true now. Just if you just include the living things right now, almost everything is a prokaryote, because every individual bacterium is an organism, right? Now, we either try not to think about them a lot of times, or we just forget they're there because they're microscopic, but they are everywhere that we find life. Now, everywhere that we find life, we define as the biosphere, right? Has a certain thickness. Anything between the thickness of the biosphere's wall is where we find life, as deep into the ground as we find living things, and as far away from the surface in the atmosphere as we find living things. That's the biosphere. Outside of the biosphere, things, you know, life has not been found, or life can't exist because of conditions. But wherever there is a possibility of life, wherever we have found life, prokaryotes inhabit those places. Maybe other things as well, but the point here is that prokaryotes are by far the most successful cell types. They were the original cells, or for a long time they were the only cells. But even now that eukaryotes have come into existence, it didn't cause the extinction of prokaryotes. They still vastly outnumber us. They're just tiny. And so, they're, in terms of the biosphere, they are essentially ubiquitous, which is simply a word that means found everywhere. Everywhere that we have found living things, we have found prokaryotes there. In some places, that's the only things that can live where that is. Well, the handprint that you see in slide 2, which is related to what we're going to do for lab tonight, reminds us of the fact that bacteria, as typical prokaryotes, are ubiquitous. You might think your hand is clean. You convince yourself that your hand is clean because it feels clean. You have cleaned it recently. But there are still millions of bacteria on it. And if you just touch your hand to an agar plate, like the plates we're going to inoculate tonight, and then let those bacteria that transfer from your hand to the plate do what bacteria do, which is reproduce. One bacterium in a tiny spot will turn into 2, and then 2 will turn into 4, 8, 16. It'll double every 20 minutes, basically. That's the generation of a bacterium, typically. And whereas they're invisible to begin with, because they're just individual bacteria that came from your hand, you give them a day and there will be so many in that same position that started as just one bacterium there that you'll see it as a colony, which is millions of bacteria by then, identical to each other because they all came from that original bacterium that you placed there. But you see here that there are thousands of colonies here corresponding to bacteria all over the hand. And it's not true of just hands. Like I said, they're everywhere that we find living things, all through this room, all through anything you encounter in life. Now, speaking of your body, did we talk about how many cells you're made of? Did I ask you that to guess? Obviously, you're multicellular, right? You're not just one huge cell, you're multicellular. But anyone have any idea roughly how many cells a normal adult human consists of? Yes. Roughly 100 trillion cells. Now that's just cells that you can claim as your cells, meaning cells that have your DNA, And so we tend to think we occupy this space we call our body. That's true. That's where your 100 trillion cells are, and you own those, so to speak. But for every one of your own cells, there's somewhere between 10 and 100 times as many bacteria. So really, the space that you call you is, in terms of individuals, mostly bacteria. And your cells are in there as well, but they're vastly outnumbered. So they're not only on your outer surface, they're all through your body. And, you know, trillions of them in your digestive tract, for instance, as well. Let's go to three. I mentioned a little bit ago that early Earth, before there were any cells, didn't even have, not only was it hot, but you didn't even have the molecular building blocks that cells are made out of. You can't have any hope of having that first cell if you don't even have the things that cells are made out of molecularly. So if you think back to 181, the biological hierarchy of organization from small things to big things, you know, it's atoms make up molecules, molecules make up organelles, organelles make up cells, and so on all the way up to the biosphere. Well, cells are made of organelles. Organelles are made of biological macromolecules. Now, macromolecules are big molecules. There are small molecules as well. I mean, water, for instance, is part of you, a big part of you. But you can't have any hope of having a living cell unless you have all four of the categories of biological macromolecules. What are those four categories? No, those are the four important elements. But those aren't even molecules. But they're not big molecules. I'm talking about large molecules. What are the four classes?
Lipids. Carbohydrates.
No, I'm not going to accept carbohydrates. That's an example of one. The reason I have a problem, a lot of people teach carbohydrates, and I'm sure you've learned this. Books will say this too. But carbohydrates is a real general term. Not all carbohydrates are big molecules. There are small ones and big ones. So I'm talking about macromolecules. If you have a carbohydrate that is a macromolecule, what is it called? What are the large carbohydrates called? Or what are the small ones called, for that matter? Carbohydrates are sugars, right? What are small sugars called? Simple sugars. Monosaccharides. They're not macromolecules, but they are carbohydrates. That's my point. So, if we're restricting our attention to just macromolecules, what are the macromolecular carbohydrates called? Polysaccharides, right. You make big molecules that are sugars by hooking together small sugars. So, yeah, that's two of the four, lipids and polysaccharides, proteins, and nucleic acids. Right. All cells need all four of those. All organisms have those. And so my point here is that you can't have that first cell unless you first have not just ordinary molecules like water and, you know, small molecules, but you also have to have these complex molecules already in place as raw materials to build that first cell. And early Earth didn't have those. Now, these biological macromolecules are not only macromolecules, but they are all four organic macromolecules. What does it mean for a molecule to be organic? Yeah, but that actually doesn't go far enough either. It is true that all organic compounds contain carbon, but not all substances that contain carbon are organic. It's kind of a fuzzy definition, historically, for historical reasons. But first of all, organic substances have to be compounds, for one thing. So carbon in pure form, like the graphite you used on the Scantron, which we call lead, but it's really graphite, that's pure carbon, but it's not considered to be organic because it's not, it's only carbon. Also, diamond, which is exactly the same stuff, it's pure carbon as well, but just hooked together differently and a lot more expensive, obviously, but a diamond is pure carbon also. That's not organic. And carbon dioxide is not considered organic, even though there's carbon in that. And there are other exceptions as well. The vast majority of carbon-containing compounds are organic, and they contain carbon as well as hydrogen, usually, almost always, and sometimes oxygen and nitrogen as well, and other things. So most of the carbon-containing substances are organic. But the point here is that the reason that there is a distinction between organic substances and inorganic, and correspondingly two subdivisions of the immense science that we call chemistry, there's organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry. The reason those words exist, though, and what organic meant originally, is obtained from an organism, organic things. And we used to believe for a long time that there was something special about living things and what they're made of, which is why we called them organic materials. We used to think that it was not possible to make the stuff that living things were made out of stuff that was inorganic. In other words, we used to believe that the only source of organic material was other organisms. Well, eventually we realized that was wrong, and now it's not hard at all to make organic compounds out of inorganic materials. Still, to make that first cell, you have to have organic macromolecules in place. All right? And what we see in slide 3 is the results in graphs of a famous set of experiments done in the 50s originally to demonstrate that important organic molecules that are required to make cells that didn't exist originally on Earth could actually come into existence by ordinary chemical reactions using inorganic material that was here originally. And so what they did was set up a system of glassware to mimic early Earth conditions. An ocean, because remember, that's where life started. An ocean that consisted of things we're pretty sure was in the early Earth's oceans, was in one globe-like piece of glass, and it was heated, because it was hot, really hot back then, and it was fitted with electrodes that could be sparked now and then to imitate lightning, which is a source of energy to drive these chemical reactions. And then another piece of glassware would just collect what evaporated off of that, representing the atmosphere. They just let this run for a while, and every once in a while, every couple of weeks or whatever, take a sample from it and see what's there. And starting without organic macromolecules, or the precursors of organic macromolecules, they didn't have to let it run very long. And remember, there was actually a billion years of this happening in real life. And it started accumulating things like amino acids, which are necessary to build proteins. And so there's no limit to the number of amino acids that there are, but we call the set of 20 amino acids that all organisms use, the biological amino acids. When they first ran it in the 50s, they got about 7 or 8 amino acids after a couple weeks of running it. They redid it in 2008, as you see, and they did it in a way that much better mimicked what we're now pretty sure was closer to how the Earth really was. And they got over 20 amino acids, so that's more than enough for that's more than all the organisms on Earth have used. So it just demonstrates that you can have inorganic precursor molecules that just through ordinary chemical means turn into organic compounds. And once those accumulate slowly, there's still no cells for a long time. But this is happening gradually, and just these molecules are continuously being built and accumulating in the environment, in the early ocean, until eventually you have the raw materials for cells. Now, that does not mean you have a cell yet, just because you have the stuff to build cells out of. In slide 4, we see that... we see a picture in the lower left of some vesicles. Now, a vesicle is not a cell. It's really just a bag that kind of looks like a cell. A bag, though, made out of membrane. The same sort of membrane that the plasma membrane is made out of. What is the chief component of a plasma membrane, molecularly speaking? What's it made out of? What kind of molecules? What is it? Well, to certain things, yeah. The plasma membrane is selectively permeable. Certain things get through, certain things don't. But in terms of the molecules that make up one plasma membrane, what are most of those molecules? What kind of lipids? It's the 181 question. Phospholipids, right, which are in cartoon form drawn as a head with two tails, right? And the phospholipids is another example, along with amino acids, of the types of things that have to be in place first. But that happens just under ordinary means. You don't need organisms to do that. Well, also, once you have a bunch of phospholipids, which are not living, they're just molecules, and you could do this today. If you have millions of phospholipids and put them into a beaker of water, they will automatically assemble, or they'll self-assemble into a phospholipid bilayer. It's a bilayer because you have one layer of phospholipids next to each other and another one forming another layer. And the bilayer is arranged so that the tails are facing each other and the heads are facing outward. And that's because phospholipids are amphipathic molecules, right? What does amphipathic mean? I couldn't hear you over there's a fan up here.
It lets certain things in
or no, that's semi-permeable or selectively permeable. An individual molecule, one of these phospholipids, is amphipathic. Pathic is a word that means feeling or preference in this sense. Now, an individual molecule doesn't have feelings or preference, but that's why we call it this. And amphi means dual, D-U-A-L, or both. Did we talk about this word before? But what are other words, though, that start with amphi that you know? Amphibious or amphibian, right? In amphibian, the bi part of that, as in biology, means life. And amphi means dual, so living a dual lifestyle, right? An amphibian lives partly in water, part of its life in water and part of its life on land. An amphitheater is another one that people usually bring up. That's theater that's partly outside and partly indoors, right? So amphipathic means having dual preference or dual feeling. That's because phospholipids are not the only amphipathic molecules. But any given amphipathic molecule is one that has one part of the molecule that is polar and another part that's nonpolar. Well, polar things like to be only around other polar things, and the same is true for nonpolar. They like to be only around nonpolar. Polar and nonpolar don't like to be next to each other. So that's why when you have a bunch of phospholipids, they will automatically form a spherical bag made out of two layers of phospholipids, arranged tail to tail, so that these tails, which are hydrocarbons and therefore non-polar. They don't like to be around water, which is polar. They're hiding from the water. The heads are the polar parts, and they don't mind being around the water outside and around the water inside the bag. So that's what a vesicle is. It's not really a cell yet, because it doesn't have everything that a cell needs. And this is not a full plasma membrane, because a plasma membrane has to be phospholipids and other things in there as well that help things get into and out of the cell. But you can't have the first cell until you have vesicles in place. And these are just automatically going to be created when you have an accumulation of phospholipids in the environment. And when they do auto form into vesicles, whatever's inside the vesicle is just a crapshoot, right? It's just that little tiny piece of the ocean that gets contained. And therefore, as vesicles continue to be created before those first cells, there's going to be some vesicles that get lucky and get a nice mixture of molecules in them that can start resembling the things that cells are made out of. And vesicles can even reproduce themselves, as you see here. Well, on the top, the graph, you have relative turbidity, which is the cloudiness of the water versus time. When you have only these precursor molecules that I'm saying are accumulating just for without any life, there is a gradual increase, and if you have billion years to wait, it doesn't matter that it's gradual, but it's a lot quicker even, the blue trace, if you have those precursor molecules and you also have volcanic clay. This clay that's mentioned here is volcanic clay, and there would be a ton of this around in the early Earth because there was so much volcanic activity. That clay surface actually acts as a catalyst and causes much more creation of vesicles and therefore a lot more turbidity. So eventually, with this happening for so many millions or hundreds of millions of years, you eventually get to something that has the ability to actually act as a living cell. And a living cell is living only because of the special kind of chemistry that's going on in it, right? The special thing about life is metabolism. Metabolism is life. Your life is just the chemistry that's going inside your cells. So eventually that became the first cell in some of these vesicles. And I'm sure it happened multiple times, but eventually it happened in a lineage that was successful in giving rise to new ones, to reproducing ones just like itself. And that was the original ancestor to everyone. That was not only the first cell, but it was a prokaryotic cell. Prokaryotes were the first organisms to exist. Well, when that happened exactly, no, we don't have the day of the day in the calendar, but slide 5 shows you what we know from fossil evidence. Now, this is the entire timeline of Earth, because remember, Earth only goes back 4.6 billion years, or roughly. And so the first part of the Earth, that would be that Hadean Eon, there was no life. We don't know exactly when the first successful cells came about, but we know from fossil evidence and the accurate dating of those fossils that it's at least a certain age. Obviously, it could be before our oldest fossils, but our oldest fossils go back at least 3.5 billion years. And however far before that, we don't know for sure. There not only are stromatolites, which don't let this black mark in the graph confuse you. That just means that this particular sample that's being photographed was this old. But the whiteness of this white arrow means that the oldest stromatolites go back 3.5 billion years. So we know life already existed at least that far back. And we also even have fossilized evidence of individual prokaryotic cells. That's what this picture is from. And they go back almost as far as well. So we can say at least 3.5, maybe 3.8 billion years ago was that first successful lineage of cells that is our ancestors.
How do we know
Because of radiometric dating of the fossils that we talked about earlier. Because of half-lives of isotopes. So that, yeah, that's how they do it for something that's that old. And by the way, these stromatolites are not only the oldest fossils, but they are just about as old as the oldest rocks on Earth. The early Earth was changing quite a bit. The oldest rocks that actually still exist on the surface of the Earth, even though they're not fossils, they're really not much older than these fossils. So life's been around for quite a while. All right, so let's go to 6 now and start talking more about present-day prokaryotes. Remember from the evolution unit that there are 3 domains of life, right? Even though there are 2 types of cells, that's a dichotomy. There are 3 domains. What are the domains? Right, eukarya, bacteria, and archaea. And I bring this up because there's 2 cell types, prokaryotic and eukaryotic. There is a domain called eukarya, but there's no domain called prokarya, right? So all of the prokaryotic organisms that ever lived are grouped in either bacteria or archaea. They are both prokaryotes, and we're studying both in this chapter. But of the prokaryotes, the bacteria are the more numerous. There's a hell of a lot of archaeans out there as well, but bacteria are more plentiful. And those are the ones that you saw in the hand print, for instance. Superficially, if you compare them, by the way, if you look at a bacterial cell and an archaeal cell side by side in a light microscope, unless you're an expert, you're not going to be able to tell them apart. They're going to just look like single cells. They have important differences molecularly. That's why we put them into 2 different domains, but they are both prokaryotes. Well, let's talk about bacteria specifically for a little bit. And we see in slide 6 3 different major shapes that they can have. So bacteria, the most successful group of organisms, are not the most varied in terms of morphology or shape. There are, these are fairly drastic different shapes. Spherical, rod-shaped, or spiral. But that's about it. There's not a huge variety of morphology or shape in bacteria. That's not their claim to fame. Instead, despite not having much morphological variety, the true claim to fame for bacteria is their biochemical versatility. Anything that has been done in biochemistry, anything that living organisms are able to do biochemically, bacteria are able to do. There's a lot of organisms that can do some of it, but not all of it. And that's one of the reasons we need bacteria, for instance. Like the things that we classify, for instance, as vitamins, they're called vitamins because they're vitally important. We'll die without them. And in most of those cases, they're things that we can't make on our own. And that's why you have to take them in your diet or you'll die. Well, our ancestor had the bacteria had the ability to make all the substances required. We have lost that along the evolutionary history. And so we have to get that from other organisms. And that's one of the things that bacteria do for us. They produce the vitamins that keep us alive. But anyway, there is a little bit of morphological variety. The spherical, rod-shaped, and spiral doesn't really go beyond that when you're talking about bacteria. If we look at slide 7, here we see a photomicrograph, really, of 2 cells. The spherical cell is the bacterium. It's connected to a tonsil cell, though, so this is in a human. Bacteria are absolutely indispensable to our existence. We can't live without them, but also, obviously, they can cause some problems, like giving you a cold, for instance. But the reason it's shown here sticking to a tonsil cell is to indicate that a lot of bacteria have a so-called capsule. Now, any cell that's ever existed, it is a cell by definition because it has a plasma membrane. All cells have a plasma membrane, right? But then some cells have, in addition to the plasma membrane, layers outside of that. Like plant cells, for instance, have a cell wall. You learned that in 181. Our animal cells don't. Fungi do. Plants do. Well, so do bacteria. They have a much thicker and tougher cell wall exterior to, or superficial to, their plasma membrane. And in some bacteria, even outside of the cell wall, you have still other stuff, which is usually a mixture of chemicals, mostly polysaccharides, that make it sticky. That's the so-called capsule. So it's like a mucus-like capsule that allows it easily to stick to things that, in this case, can invade. Well, not all bacteria have a capsule, but there are also other ways that bacteria can stick to things, as you see in slide 8. These long, colorized, yellow, hair-like structures, as you see, are called fimbriae. That's a plural. If you take away the E, it's fimbria. That just means one of them. But anyway, these are not truly hair. It's not made out of the same stuff our hair is. But they look like little spiky hairs, allowing it to stick in place. And slide 9 shows us that certain bacteria also have specialized structures sticking out from them called flagella, singular flagellum. Flagella are locomotory devices. Locomotory means moving from one place to another, which can also be called, by the way, taxis. Now, taxis and taxis are spelled exactly the same way, but taxis is the process of moving. By the way, that's why a taxi is called that. Taxis is movement in response to some sort of stimulus. Anyway, certain bacteria are able to freely move through their medium in which they live, like water, for instance, by propeller motion. A flagellum is a helical structure, has a corkscrew shape, and if you spin a corkscrew, it acts just like a screw propeller on a boat or submarine. So it's not that they whip back and forth and bend, they stay as a corkscrew. When we look at them in two dimensions, it looks like they're going back and forth. But you're only looking at one side of a three-dimensional helix. These things spin, by the way, exactly like ATP synthase spins. Do you remember learning about ATP synthase? What cellular process uses ATP synthase? Another 181 question. Cellular respiration. Remember that the big payoff in terms of ATP after you have the electron transport chain, which pumps protons, is for those protons to diffuse back and spins the ATP synthase molecules to make ATP? Well, maybe you don't remember, but that's what you learned in 181. This is working the same way, but you're using it for the opposite reason, really. The other one was spun so that you could make ATP. This one works in reverse, basically. The bacterium uses ATP in order to cause it to spin, and that's what propels it through the water. Brings us to slide 10. A table, as you see, of nutritional modes, major nutritional modes, not just for bacteria, this is for all organisms. But notice that there are two major sections here in all caps. Autotroph and heterotroph. Any given organism is classified either as an autotroph or a heterotroph. The troph part of that word refers to nutrition, how you get your nutrition. Auto means self, right? So autotroph literally means self-feeding, whereas hetero means other. Heterotrophs are feed on others. They use others for their nutrition is what I mean by that. And so other words, these are words that really refer to what's happening chemically, but they have corresponding words that we use in ecology, which we'll talk about in the last unit. But ecologically, autotrophs are known as producers, and heterotrophs are known as consumers. Any given individual is one or the other. In the second and third columns next to mode are the two requirements of life, energy source and carbon source. All organisms are organic because they're made out of these organic macromolecules, carbon-containing molecules. So to make the molecules that they need to live, they need carbon. Absolutely indispensable. But they also obviously need energy because a lot of the molecules that they make, especially the big ones, requires energy. It takes energy to build big things out of small things, right? That's anabolic, part of metabolism that's anabolic, meaning building up rather than tearing down. We tear down big molecules that we take in as food so that that gives us the energy to then build big things out of the small things. So any organism, of whether it's unicellular or multicellular, needs carbon and needs energy. Therefore, there are four overall possibilities. Some organisms can use light as a source of energy. And they therefore would be phototrophs by the, that's just a word by itself. But if they're able to use light, and photo means light, as their energy source, and they're able to use carbon in an inorganic form, and remember I said that carbon dioxide is considered inorganic, then they are called photoautotrophs. Because inorganic carbon, like carbon dioxide, that's not part of an organism, right? All you need is light and inorganic carbon in the form of carbon dioxide, and you can make your own food. That's exactly what producers do. Like plants, for instance. But plants didn't exist for a long time after photosynthesis already existed. Photosynthesis first evolved in prokaryotes, back when prokaryotes were the only organisms to exist, before eukaryotes came on the scene. All right, now a chemoautotroph is still an autotroph, as the name indicates, but it's an autotroph because it's able to use inorganic carbon as its carbon source. It's a chemoautotroph if it's able to use chemical energy to drive the reactions. And there aren't nearly as many chemoautotrophs as there are photoautotrophs. It's usually light that's driving these reactions. But there are some chemoautotrophs that exist in places that are totally dark, like at the bottom of the ocean. All right, then you get to the heterotrophs, the consumers. What makes them heterotrophs is that they have to have their carbon that they absolutely need for their own organic compounds. That carbon has to come already in organic form. So they have to take in organic molecules that other organisms have already produced. Because all they can do is rearrange it. They can't make organic out of inorganic. And that's what makes them a heterotroph. Well, there are some organisms that are able to use light as their source of energy, even though they have to have organic compounds as their carbon source. And those are called photoheterotrophs. And then there are those that need energy from organic compounds, which we call food. That's where they get their energy, not from light. And they also have to have organic compounds as their source of carbon. These are the chemo-heterotrophs of the world. Now, which of these four are we? Right, we are chemo-heterotrophs. We have to get energy from food that we eat, and food is organic material from another organism. That provides the energy from breaking those compounds down to release that energy. But those organic compounds also serve as a source of carbon. We can't use carbon dioxide to build our molecules. Otherwise, we would be autotrophs, not heterotrophs. So any given organism is one of these four. The major point of putting in this table, which covers all organisms, into this chapter, which is about prokaryotes, is that prokaryotes are the only group of organisms that represent all four possibilities. Photoheterotrophs, only prokaryotes can do that. There are no eukaryotes that are photoheterotrophs. All animals, which we're examples of, are chemoheterotrophs, for instance. There are eukaryotes that are photoautotrophs. Those are the plants and the algae. But the point is, every one of these four possibilities, there are prokaryotes that can do that, and some of them, only prokaryotes are doing it. So that's what I was meant earlier when I said the true claim to fame for prokaryotes, other than just their sheer success in terms of numbers, is that they're able to do all of biochemistry. If it's possible biochemically, a prokaryote can do it. So we're used to thinking about photosynthesis and cellular respiration, or at least I thought you were used to thinking about that, but the 181 questions kind of makes me wonder. But you know that you studied cellular respiration at one point in your life, right? And photosynthesis, even though you might have forgotten the details. Well, we're used to thinking about those in terms of eukaryotes doing them, right? Photosynthesis, we're used to thinking about plants doing it, or algae maybe. Cellular respiration, our own cells do, right? But plant cells do as well. There's nothing new about those. But like I mentioned a little bit ago about photosynthesis, both of these things, photosynthesis and cellular respiration, existed long before you had the first eukaryotic organism. And that's because both of these were invented, so to speak, evolutionarily by bacteria. Prokaryotes were the first photosynthetic organisms, and they were the first respiring organisms. But when you think about it in terms of how eukaryotes do it, I'm sure you remember this. What does photosynthesis occur in? What cell part? What organelle? Chloroplasts. And what about cellular respiration? Where does cellular respiration occur in your own cells? Where? Mitochondria. Chloroplasts and mitochondria are both examples of membrane-bounded organelles, right? Organelles that are enclosed or bounded by their own membranes. So they form their own little compartments within the cell. That's what makes a eukaryotic cell a eukaryote. It has membrane-bounded organelles, including the nucleus and all the other kinds, like endoplasmic reticulum and so on. Prokaryotic cells don't have membrane-bounded organelles. They not only don't have a nucleus, which is why they're called prokaryotes, but they also don't have any other membrane-bounded organelles. So they have one membrane, the plasma membrane. Even though they only have one membrane, though, they can still, certain bacteria can still photosynthesize, just like a eukaryotic cell does with its own special compartment called a chloroplast, because their one membrane that they have, the plasma membrane, can actually be elaborately folded back and forth, giving them almost their own compartments. Not quite like a true chloroplast, but this was how photosynthesis originated. All right? And similarly, even though there's no mitochondrion in any bacterium, because that's another membrane-bounded organelle, the one plasma membrane can be elaborately folded to cause pretty much the same situation that you have inside a mitochondrion. And that's how cellular respiration got started. By the way, what makes respiration respiration is that some exterior to the process, some molecule that's, or some particle that's exterior to the process, needs to serve as an electron acceptor, right? This, have you ever thought about why you need oxygen? I mean, most students say, because I'll die without it, but that's not what I mean. Well, why will you die without oxygen? What does it do for you? Well, really, there's almost only one use for it, and otherwise it's harmful to you. And that's to serve as the final electron acceptor. Those electrons that get stripped from the food that you eat need to go somewhere, ultimately. Electrons and protons, really, in the form of hydrogens that get stripped from your food. Those end up being picked up by the oxygen you breathe. That turns that oxygen into water, because you're adding hydrogen to oxygen. And that allows us to make a hell of a lot more ATP per amount of food that we eat originally. So it's really much more efficient. That happens in mitochondria, but the whole thing got started in bacteria. But I bring this up because early on in Earth's biological history, so there was already organisms, but early on, after there were organisms, there was still no oxygen in the atmosphere. The reason that there is oxygen is also thanks to bacteria. Because once you have photosynthetic bacteria evolved way before the first eukaryotes, this is what created the oxygen and gradually built it up in the atmosphere. Because remember when you studied photosynthesis that it is kind of like the reverse of cellular respiration. So instead of requiring oxygen and turning it into water, it requires water and turns it into oxygen. Right? And that's how oxygen came to be in the atmosphere. It had to gradually, over many millions of years, get to a level where, well, that, first of all, that killed a lot of things, because oxygen is harmful to a lot of things. But once you have that oxygen in the atmosphere, that gave conditions for natural selection to favor something that could take advantage of that oxygen, which is how cellular respiration started, in also other bacteria. And then eventually eukaryotes came on the scene, and by then there was already oxygen to take advantage of. So the point is, bacteria are vitally important for a lot of reasons. If we look at 12 now, this white thing is not a cell, by the way. It's much smaller than a cell. The cell that this is part of would be much bigger than this room if we saw the whole thing. What we're looking at here is just part of the interior of a bacterium, part of the cytoplasm. Since bacteria are prokaryotes, meaning they have only one membrane, they only really have one compartment, and that whole compartment that the membrane contains is called the cytoplasm. That's the whole interior of a bacterium, right? And so they don't have a special compartment for their DNA like eukaryotic cells do. They don't have a nucleus, in other words. But they need DNA for the same reason that we need DNA. They have DNA in their cytoplasm. And this is just a little bit of that cytoplasm. The squiggle here that looks like spaghetti is DNA. And so this is another fundamental difference between prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. I already mentioned one, which is presence or absence of membrane-bounded organelles. But another fundamental difference is that in a prokaryotic cell, there is typically one chromosome. The squiggle that you see here is all one DNA, making up one chromosome. A chromosome is a single DNA, well, a single double-stranded DNA. Okay? Remember that genes are sequences of DNA nucleotides, but that each gene is only a tiny fraction of the overall sequence that we call the chromosome. There are many genes in a chromosome. But back to what I was saying, a bacteria, a typical prokaryotic cell will contain just one chromosome, whereas a eukaryotic cell has some number of chromosomes, which depends on the species. Like for humans, it's 23. Corn, it's like 40. Other things, it's fewer than us. Just depends on the species. Not only that, one versus several, but the shapes are different. The one chromosome that a bacterium has, or a prokaryote in general, not just a bacterium, is circular, so-called circular chromosome, because it has no ends. It comes back and joins onto itself. Not a circle right here, but if you spread it all out, it would be a circle. Whereas the chromosomes, however many there are, in a eukaryotic cell, are linear chromosomes. They each have two ends. That's another fundamental difference. Well, the one chromosome that a bacterium has contains all of the genes that are required to code for the proteins that that cell needs to live. Whereas our genes are spread out over multiple chromosomes. And typically the genome, which simply means the entirety of all the DNA in an organism, and when we're talking about a prokaryotic organism, it's just that one cell. The genome of a prokaryote is smaller than for a eukaryotic cell. So they not only have one chromosome versus many, they also don't have as many total genes as a eukaryotic cell does. But they have, you know, if their DNA exists only as that one chromosome, all those genes that are on that chromosome will be essential genes. They need every one of those. On the other hand, as you see in this picture, there are much smaller loops that might or might not, they don't have to be present, can be in the cell as well. These are called plasmids. Each plasmid is like a tiny chromosome containing just a very small number of genes, but it's a separate loop. And it doesn't have to be there. The chromosome has to be there. And that contains all the necessary genes. Plasmids, if they are present, contain extra genes that code for other proteins that aren't necessary for it to be alive, but will give it extra abilities, right? Because remember, proteins give you your traits, or any organism its traits. So if you have additional genes that give you the ability to make other proteins beyond the ones that you absolutely require, then you can have the ability to do other things that these proteins allow you to do. And that's true for bacteria. Those are called plasmids. 13. Now, we officially say that all prokaryotes are unicellular, meaning that a single cell is the individual organism. And some of them live solitary lifestyles. So it's just one cell, not caring what other cells are doing, not attached to other cells, just living a solitary lifestyle. But there are also colonial bacteria, colonial prokaryotes, including bacteria, which is what we're looking at here. We still technically say that each of these cells is a different individual, but they are living a colonial lifestyle because they're hooked together. The reason that we don't qualify this as multicellular, because to be multicellular, you have to have multiple different kinds of cells doing different jobs and cooperating with each other. Well, this actually blurs that line, which is why it just goes to show you that these definitions we come up with are artificial. They're just arbitrarily drawn by us. So we don't consider this to be multicellular, but I don't know why we don't. Because there are heterocysts, which do one job, namely carbon fixation, and other cells that are doing photosynthesis. The photosynthetic cells don't undergo, not carbon fixation, nitrogen fixation in the heterocysts. The photosynthetic cells are not undergoing nitrogen fixation, and the heterocysts are not undergoing photosynthesis, and they both need each other. And they both send these materials that they produce to the other cells. So that really fits the definition of multicellular. Still, we don't really call it that. Anyway, no matter how you define multicellular, it's definitely true that some kinds of prokaryotes live a colonial lifestyle, at least. All right, now, I'm not quite to 14 yet because I'm missing a picture to show you. So this is one I'm just going to have to describe in words. But I need to tell you that there are three major ways in which horizontal gene transfer occurs in bacteria. And we better start by having someone remind us what horizontal gene transfer is to begin with. We've talked about this before. Right. Horizontal gene transfer is transfer other by means other than reproduction, right? Vertical gene transfer is transfer of DNA from a parent to its offspring. That's what you're familiar with. Horizontal gene transfer is transfer of DNA from one cell to another cell that is not that cell's offspring. And there's three major ways in which that can occur in bacteria. The first of which I don't have a picture for. Let me list what these are, though. First is transformation. I'll put that first because I'll get that out of the way without the picture. Then you have transduction. And the third is conjugation. Transformation, which is the one I don't have a picture for. Transformation is taking up of naked DNA from the environment by a bacterial cell. By naked DNA, what I mean is that it's DNA that is no longer in a cell. Some cell has died and spilled its DNA out into the environment. And under the right circumstances, a bacterium can come along and take that DNA up into its own cell and start using it as though it's its own DNA. Even though that DNA might have come from a totally different kind of organism. Now, why, by the way, could a gene that's on DNA from a different organism ever work in a bacterium? If it didn't come from a bacterium, how could that work? Well, genes, what are genes actually doing? What is the purpose of a gene? Well, that's one. There's two major functions of DNA. To replicate so that you can make new cells. And that's not what we're talking about here. What's the other major job besides replication? What is it? Yeah, and specifically to be used in the process of transcription. Transcription is using the code or the information that's in DNA to create an RNA molecule, right? And then if it's a protein coding gene, that RNA that's produced is messenger RNA, and that's used in translation to assemble a protein, right? So the protein coding genes are really codes, indirect codes for how to make a protein. What I'm saying is if a bacterium takes up DNA that's not from a bacterium and it has genes in it from some other organism, how can that make sense? That code for how to build a non-bacterial protein in some other organism, how can that make sense to a bacterium? It makes sense to the bacterium or any other organism because of the universality of the genetic code. It's not a genetic code for humans, a genetic code for pine trees, and so on. It's one genetic code that all organisms use. So a gene means the same protein in any organism. All right. And by the way, that universality of the genetic code is one of the very strong bits of evidence pointing to us all coming from an original successful lineage of cells, those first prokaryotes, because we still all use the same genetic code. Okay, anyway, that's transformation. And it doesn't always happen just because there's naked DNA in the environment. I said the conditions have to be right. But if the conditions are right, that DNA can be taken up. Now notice that means that the bacterium now has a different phenotype. It is genetically different from what it was before it transformed. It still has its original genes on its chromosome, but now it has additional genes. And by the way, as part of successful transformation, they actually can be incorporated into the chromosome. So not only is that bacterium now genetically a different organism, but when it reproduces into two new bacteria, they will have these new genes as well. But notice that is horizontal gene transfer, right? It didn't come from a parent. All right, the next way is what we do see in slide 14, and that's transduction. Transduction is also horizontal gene transfer, so the DNA doesn't come from a parent, but it's different from transformation because it involves a virus. A little bit ago, we were talking about the fact that a virus is not an organism, right? They're not really alive. They don't have their own metabolism, because metabolism is chemical reactions. That's not happening for a virus. It's not an organism because it does not have a cell. But obviously, it's a biotic entity, meaning part of biology, because it interacts with cells. Well, when you get down to it, a typical virus is really just two macromolecules. It's a piece of DNA. In most cases, it could be RNA as well, but most of them are DNA. And then wrapping around that DNA is a protein. So you have a nucleic acid and a protein, two of the four macromolecules. And that's all it is as a virus. But if it sticks to the surface of a bacterium, in other words, if it's a virus that specifically invades bacteria, we call it a bacteriophage. A word that literally means bacteria eating. That's not really what's happening. Obviously, the virus doesn't eat the bacterium, but it invades bacteria. Be careful with the word, though. A bacteriophage is not a bacterium. A bacteriophage is a virus that can invade bacteria. Other viruses can invade our cells, right? Which is why we get colds, for instance. Okay, well anyway, here you have a bacteriophage. It's the purplish thing in this cartoon. And if it, remember, it's just DNA wrapped in protein. If it connects to the outside surface of a bacterium, the DNA in its core gets injected into the cytoplasm of the bacterium. And so the reason that from the viewpoint of the virus, the reason they're doing this is so that it can produce new viruses. Right? Now think about what a virus is. I've said it already twice. It's just a piece of DNA and it's a protein. Well, the DNA, just like any stretch of DNA, can contain genes, right? And their genetic code is universal, so any cell can read that gene. When it gets injected into the bacterium, in most cases, all that leads to, it's the eventual death of the bacterium, but what it leads to is that the bacterium thinks this its own DNA. We just mentioned the two things that DNA does, which is replicate, produce new copies, and also gets transcribed. Well, it does both of these things inside the bacterium. When it replicates, now you have multiple copies of this viral DNA, enough for several different viruses, right? But that's just the DNA. In addition to being replicated, though, it can then be transcribed using the machinery inside the bacterial cell to read those genes. And what kind of proteins do you think are coded for by the genes that are on that viral DNA? The protein that forms the capsule that wraps around the DNA to begin with, right? So you fool the bacterium into making many copies of DNA and then many copies of the protein that wrap around the DNA to make multiple copies of that original virus. Eventually, there are so many of these made that it just explodes the bacterium. Death of the bacterium, but that's how viruses get reproduced. They don't reproduce on their own. They have to have a cell do that. Anyway, sometimes a cell survives this. And not only will it survive it, but the bacterium will take up that viral DNA and start using it as its own DNA, just like in transformation. Only it came from a virus instead. And that's what qualifies it as transduction. And so just like in transformation, if it survives getting this viral DNA, it gives it new abilities because it gives it additional genes beyond the ones that it already had in its chromosome. The third and final of the three kinds of horizontal gene transfer that occur in bacteria is conjugation, which means to join together, to conjoin, or conjugate, means to join together. We see that happening here between two bacteria in slide 15. One bacterium, the other bacterium, and something that is termed in this figure a sex pilus. Not really a good term because it's not truly sex that's happening here. Bacteria are asexual. It's actually not only bad because it says sex, but it's bad because it says pilus, which means hair. And it's not really a hair either. A hair is more or less like a rod. This is more like a hollow tunnel, which is why a better name for this besides sex pilus is conjugation tube, which can also be called. But anyway, a conjugation tube is a literal tunnel that gets formed between two different bacteria. Now, only one of those two bacteria is able to construct the conjugation tube. And I don't know which one in this picture did it, but one of them built it and hooked it to the other one. Just like a tunnel, something can pass through it. What is it that you suppose gets passed through the tunnel? What is it? DNA, which contains genes, yes. So a sex pilus, or better yet, a conjugation tube, is a passageway that allows DNA to get passed from one bacterium to the other, from the donor to the recipient. Now, a bacterium is not going to give up its one circular chromosome, its main genes. So that's not what gets passed through the sex pilus. What kind of DNA does get passed through that's not part of the chromosome? What did we talk about? A plasmid, exactly. So, the reason that only one of these bacteria has the ability to build this conjugation tube, which is made of proteins, is because it's the only one that has those genes. Those genes are on a small plasmid that one bacterium happens to have. That gives it the ability to build the tunnel, and then the plasmid itself gets strung through it so that the recipient now has that plasmid and can go do the same thing to some other bacterium. But when the plasmid gets passed to the recipient, it doesn't get lost from the original bacterium, because just like a chromosome, a small plasmid can also be replicated first. It replicates it, so it has two copies of the plasmid, and then it sends one copy through the conjugation tube to the recipient, turning it into the other kind of bacterium that now can do the same thing to others. Well, we see this in cartoon form, which is easier to follow in slide 16. The brown double helix is the large singular circular chromosome. That's not involved. The blue thing is the plasmid. And so the F plus is the one that has the plasmid to begin with. The F minus, the recipient, doesn't have it. So the proteins that is called the conjugation tube here is called a third name, mating bridge. Still, it's not really, well, I guess it's mating in the sense they're coming together, but it's not sexual. Anyway, the proteins that make that tunnel cannot be built by this one. It has to be built by this one because it requires genes that are in that plasmid. Once it's built, then one of the two copies gets strung through it, and now you have two F plus cells. And when they separate again, they can both go and do the same thing to others. By the way, well, I won't even mention that. It's not necessary. Let's go to slide 17. We've looked at this overall tree of life before. It didn't look exactly like this, but obviously not all the details are shown here. There are millions of species, so you would really, if you drew the whole thing, you'd have to have millions of terminal branches. But the major groups are shown here, and the main point, as we've talked about many times, is that there is one universal ancestor. That's that first successful lineage of prokaryotic cells on Earth, and they are the ancestor of all of us. That's no news. Well, actually, none of this is news. I've said this before, but notice that we have the three domains listed here. Even though there's two cell types, there are three domains for good evidential reasons: eukarya, archaea, and bacteria. And even though prokaryotes are represented by bacteria and archaea, and the other way around. Even though bacteria and archaea are both prokaryotes, and therefore you might think they are more closely related to each other than either is to us eukaryotes, that's not true. Evidence says that eukarya and archaea are more closely related to each other than either is to bacteria, and that bacteria represent the basal lineage in the overall tree of life, right? Because they sprang directly from the original ancestor. The other thing that sprang from the original ancestor then split into these other two domains. That's what we see here. I don't want to get bogged down in the details of 18, and I definitely don't want you to memorize all these facts. This just lists a bunch of important evidence for why we do say that there are three distinct domains. Like I said, you look at a bacterium and an archaean under a microscope, they look identical. But when you really study the molecules they're made out of and how those molecules evolved, then it makes sense to put them into their own groups. You keep the archaeans separate from the bacteria. And also what you see from this, if you go through it, is that there's good reason for what I said before, that archaeans and eukaryotes are more closely related to each other than either is to bacteria, because there are some things that we share that bacteria don't. So that's how the phylogenetic tree was drawn. Now, speaking of archaeans, by the way, the domain is called archaea, always capitalized like all domains. Something that belongs in the domain archaea, an individual member of archaea, is called an archaean with an O. Okay, so that's why when I say archaeans, which I've said a couple times already, that's what I'm pronouncing. Whereas a member of the domain bacteria are called bacteria, or bacterium for a singular. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about archaeans, because we've been talking mostly about bacteria. They're fellow prokaryotes, though. Slide 19 is a photograph of just one of several hot springs, sulfurous hot springs, and very salty hot springs in Yellowstone, which is a very cool place to visit if you never have. But anyway, very hot water, effectively the boiling point of water. And you know from experience that the safest water to drink, if you're unsure, is water that you boil, right? That's why if you're unsure of your water, you boil it. That's not a guarantee it's going to be safe, though, because, yes, boiling will kill most organisms. They just cannot withstand that temperature. Why can't they, by the way? What does heating them up do? Several things, but what does it do to their proteins? It denatures them, right? It causes them to lose their shape, and proteins have to have a specific shape to work. So it just makes them useless. That kills most things because they can't tolerate these high temperatures. But that's not true for certain archaeans. There are some archaeans that not only survive boiling point and even sometimes above boiling point of water, but that's actually their preferred temperature. They do best at those high temperatures. That's just one example of an extremophile. Extremophile is any lover of extremes. That's what the word literally means. And archaeans, even though they're not all extremophiles, and we're finding more and more of them in ordinary situations all the time, we've known for a long time that a lot of archaeans inhabit extreme environments. And so one type of an extremophile is a thermophile, meaning lover of heat. And that's the kind that you find here. A different kind are halophiles, which literally means lovers of salt. Now, there's plenty of life in the ocean, which is salty, but you don't find plenty of life in the body of water that's much saltier than the ocean that we call the Dead Sea for that reason. No fish in the Dead Sea because it's just way too salty. But there are halophilic archaeans that just love it there. They not only survive that saltiness, they thrive on it. So even though they're not all extremophiles, many of them are. Here on slide 20, we have a picture. We don't actually see the archaeans here, but it's evidence that there are thermophilic archaeans here at a hydrothermal vent down at the bottom of the ocean, at the ocean floor, where volcanoes are continuously erupting stuff that's way too hot for most things to live. Well, it also gives it raw materials for these things to be chemosynthetic. They're chemoautotrophs. And if it weren't for the archaeans there, you wouldn't have the animals that are also living here. Because animals are all consumers. They're all heterotrophs. They have to have producers there to give them the stuff that they need to live. Well, these tube worms that you see here are heterotrophs that can exist only because there are producers there that are archaeans, thermophilic archaeans, that are chemoautotrophs. Now we have a couple slides really about the ecological importance of prokaryotes. There are multiple individual reasons why the rest of the world absolutely cannot live without prokaryotes. Not aside from the fact that we came from prokaryotes. I mean, just putting that aside, living now would still be impossible without them for many reasons. Here you see how important they are to plants. When there aren't any bacteria present in the soil, in this experimental example, the plants didn't do nearly as good a job of taking up potassium, which they absolutely require to continue to live. The bacteria free that potassium up in the soil and make it a lot more available for uptake via the root system of the plants. So that's what they were doing in the three yellow bars, or gray bars. Green bars. 22. This is an example of a... Well, this fish is called a headlight fish. It needs a headlight because even though we can plainly see the fish, the only reason we can is because this was a flash photograph, which probably was a very weird thing for the animal to experience because it lives in total darkness, so far down in the ocean that no light penetrates at all. So everything that lives at those depths is in almost total darkness. The only light is bioluminescence. In other words, light that's produced by chemical reactions occurring in organisms. And so that's true for this headlight that's right under the eye of this fish, lighting up what's in front of it so that it can see to eat. It's not the fish, though, that is undergoing the chemical reactions that give off the light. Instead, it's bacteria that live inside the part of the body that's pouch-like that forms this headlight. So this is an example of one of many that we'll see of symbiosis. We'll talk much more about it when we get to the ecology unit. But think about what this word means. Osis means condition. Bio means life. And sim means together. So it means the condition of living together. It's a close living relationship between two different species. Well, this is not only an example of symbiosis because you have bacteria living in close relationship with the fish, but since one of the two species is living inside the other species, it's more specifically called endosymbiosis. Endo meaning within, of course. And so this is an important ecological interaction, right? This fish really relies on it. Well, I've given you a lot of examples, or several examples, of why prokaryotes are good, absolutely necessary. But obviously there's the bad side of prokaryotes, specifically bacteria. We don't know, it's not to say that there aren't any, but we don't know of any archaeans, which are prokaryotes, of course, that can cause human diseases. But obviously there are some bacteria that cause human diseases, right? You're already aware of that. Here we have Lyme disease, which we like to blame on ticks, but the tick is not causing the disease. The tick is just carrying the bacterium that actually causes the disease in humans. Lyme disease is a big problem in this country. It's the most common bacterially caused or pest caused disease. And it can be debilitating. So, obviously, yes, there are downsides to prokaryotes as well, but that's also part of ecology. Ecology is all about interaction, whether it's good or bad. Slide 24, an example of biotechnological use. Is that a question?
Yes. And according to the Lyme disease, what is green?
That's a fungus. Yeah. So in slide 24, we have a couple examples of biotechnology. Biotechnology refers to humans using some sort of organism to produce some sort of product for human use, whether it's medicine or anything else. We basically take advantage of something that an organism can do. Well, the picture in slide A shows you some bacteria that are able to make a chemical that is really just biological plastic. We can form it into, we can just feed the bacteria, make tons of this stuff, make it into pellets, which then can be formed just like other plastics, like PVC or whatever. Only it's made from an organism and therefore biodegradable. So we can use it just like plastic, but it's not going to last forever. It'll degrade, which is beneficial, of course. And then the other picture at the gas pump is another example of biotechnological use of bacteria. You can You can take advantage of the fermenting capacity of bacteria. Fermentation produces in certain species. And when our cells ferment, we form lactic acid, but other things that ferment will form alcohol. And so bacteria can be huge factories for making alcohol, which then gets added to gasoline seasonally. There's all kinds of other examples. Like, for instance, this is how most of the insulin nowadays is made. It wasn't all that long ago that type 1 diabetics that absolutely require insulin to live had to get their insulin from hogs that were slaughtered. Because their insulin, even though it's not exactly the same as human insulin, as a fellow mammal, it's good enough and it worked for them. But that relies on there being enough available, enough hogs to be slaughtered. And also, certain diabetics didn't really react well to insulin from pigs. So nowadays, we just genetically engineer bacteria. We artificially insert genes from humans, the gene responsible for coding for insulin, into a bacterium, and because of that universality of the genetic code, now that new genetically modified bacterium and all of its children will be able to produce insulin that's exactly like human insulin. It is human insulin, it's just made by bacteria instead. And that works much better for the diabetics. And we can control how much is made. Slide 25, another use of bacteria. In this case, it's not really biotechnology. It's more what we call bioremediation. Remediation refers to cleaning up our messes, basically. Bioremediation refers to using some sort of organism to clean up our messes for us. Like oil spills, for instance. Well, oil is organic material. It came from long dead stuff that was once alive. And so, getting back to this biochemical versatility of bacteria that are really their claim to fame, if there's anything that's organic, whether it actually came from organisms, or whether it's a brand new organic compound that we invented chemically, because of the biochemical versatility of bacteria, you can either find some naturally living bacteria that can use that stuff as food, or you can genetically engineer one nowadays that will be able to use it as food. And so that's what we do. We clean up oil spills, which would be impossible to go clean up manually, by spraying it with a suspension of bacterial cells that are specifically bacteria that can eat that stuff, like the oil or other things that we pollute the environment with. That is it for the lecture. That's not it for the night.